How did Claire Booth Luce possibly fit so many lives into one lifetime? Her biographer, Sylvia Jukes Morris, joins us to talk about her new book, Price of Fame.
And she was a real rabble-rouser, as it turned out. She packed out Madison Square Garden and got standing ovations every time she spoke. So she realized that perhaps at heart she was a politician.
What role does poetry serve in an internet age? As part of this week's look at contemporary poetry, Greg Coles will talk to David Lehman about his essay, Poetry versus Technology.
The means of writing affects the outcome. If you are used to writing instant messages, you may use that as a model for what a poem might be like.
My colleagues John Williams, Carl Sagal, and I will talk about what's going on in the literary world this week. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Sylvia Jukes Morris joins us now. She is the author of Price of Fame, The Honorable Claire Booth Luce, reviewed in this week's issue by Maureen Dowd. Hi, Sylvia.
Hello.
So this is, you know, you have probably one of the richest subjects for a biographer in Claire Booth Luce. This is the second volume. The first one was Rage for Fame. And that came out how many years ago?
It came out in 97, so okay. That's like 17 years.
17 years. Yeah. So how many years have you devoted to the subject of Claire Booth Luce in total now?
Well, she was alive when I, not when I started writing, but when I started researching. And I met her in 1980, and she gave me permission to go ahead. That means go ahead and use her papers in the Library of Congress, which actually was sealed at that point. They were larger than most presidential collections, actually, over 1,000 boxes.
Wow.
And that didn't include all the stuff she had kept behind, the more sensitive material, the diaries and the love letters and stuff, which she still had at her house in Hawaii. So eventually I had to go there, too, and look at those.
So you've spent how many years now in total?
Research is a prolonged business, particularly when what happened to me, and has happened also to my husband, when the papers don't show up where they should be. And in her case, she shipped these private documents from Hawaii to the Library of Congress, and they never arrived. And I had only had a chance to glance at them in 3 weeks out there. I didn't Xerox anything, didn't have anything, any time for that. After she died, somebody called me from the warehouse and said, there's a big box of a big trunk of papers here, which are clearly labeled Library of Congress, but they were shipped here with her old furniture and paintings and stuff she was going to sell off at some point. And so that really delayed the project by many, many years, because about 7 or 8 years it was delayed because of that. Because all the important stuff was really in that trunk.
I assume gave you a lot of time to contemplate what was a very full life. And before I go into that, I want to explain your aside about your husband, Edmund Morris, who, of course, is the biographer of Teddy Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan, and is now working on a book about Edison.
Yes.
A lot of biography in the family. So you pick up the story when she is 39 years old, right, in 1943?
Yes.
Tell us briefly, just for those who aren't familiar with Claire Booth Luce, about her life up to that point.
Well, she was born, as they say, on the wrong side of the track. She was born in Spanish Harlem, 125th Street, probably illegitimate, to a woman who aspired to be in the theater but never really made it past a typing pool of some kind, and a man called Franklin Booth, who actually was a highly intelligent man who knew Latin and played the violin and the piano and actually had a piano factory for many years. But he fell on hard times and ended up being a soft drink salesman. And they left New York, lived in Tennessee and Memphis and Chicago, and eventually the couple split up. I don't think they ever married, because I went all over America looking for the marriage certificate, never found it in any place they lived. And Claire herself, at the end of her life, or at least at the end, near the end of Harry Luce's life, wrote a letter saying, I was born probably illegitimate. She didn't quite want to face that, because it's no big deal today, but in those days,
right,
it was considered.
And Harry was, of course, Henry Luce of time.
Yes. She married, he was her second husband. She married first a man called George Brokaw, who was the heir to a fortune. His father had made his fortune making Civil War uniforms. But he was quite a good golfer. but drank a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had one child with him, a daughter, Anne. After 6 years, they were divorced. And shortly after that, about 3 years, 4 years after that, she met Henry Luce.
And what was she doing professionally when she met Henry Luce?
Professionally, of course, after the divorce, she could have become just a society matron because she had a large alimony from Mr. Brokaw. But she had a brain, and she was restless. And she met Condé Nast one night at a dinner party. They were friends already.
For those who don't realize that this is actually a person.
Yes, Condé Nast was actually a person. And he, of course, owned House and Garden and Vanity Fair and Vogue and all those magazines. And she asked for a job on Vogue. And he said, oh, no, all you society women, he said, you'll go off to Palm Beach in the winter and you'll go to Newport in the summer, and I will never see you at the office. She said, no, I will do it, but he still wouldn't bend. So she just simply took herself down to the Vogue offices and sat there and said she was the new caption writer. And when the checks came around at the end of the week, of course, she didn't get one. So she said, oh, well, Miss Wolfe, she's in the editor of Vogue, was in Paris at the collections, and I'm sure she'll put my name on the list when she gets back. So when Edmund Wolman Chase got back, she thought Condé Nast had hired her, and Condé Nast thought the editor had hired her, and neither of them had. So anyway, she progressed from caption writer to short article writer and short story writer. And Frank Crowninshield, who was the editor of Vanity Fair in those days, he used to snoop around the Vogue offices looking for talent. And he'd found Dorothy Parker that way. And then he found Claire Booth Luce.
Now, Dorothy
Claire
Parker.
Brokaw in those days.
Right.
And so he stole her away, too.
It's interesting to think of her as a caption writer because, of course, she was a great wit, as was Dorothy Parker, who,
yes.
Tell the story of what she once wrote of Claire Booth Luce.
Well, Claire, after she became editor of Vanity Fair, she always had a low boring point, so she moved on very quickly to new things and she started to write plays. And one of the things she did was when the war began, she took herself off to Europe during the phony war, before the war was actually had really begun, 1940, and she wrote a book called Europe in the Spring, all about the generals that she had interviewed and the Parisians who were dreading the coming of the Nazis, and she was watching the sandbags put in place in London. And she came back and wrote this book, Europe in the Spring, and Dorothy Parker reviewed it, and the title of the review was All Claire on the Western Front.
That's so great. Yeah, so she was an editor, obviously, and a writer, and briefly of kind of foreign correspondent. But those were just a couple of her professions. You mentioned the plays. She's
yes.
most famous for The Women. How did she get into playwriting?
Well, she really wanted to be an actress at the beginning, and her mother put her on the stage at an early age when she was 9 or 10 years old. She understudied Mary Pickford in a Broadway play. And from there, she went and made a silent movie at the Edison Studios in New Jersey. I saw a clip of that movie. They have it at the Museum of Modern Art. And she looks at the camera all the time. And you're not supposed never to look at the camera, actually. You look
right.
at the people you're acting with. So she knew she wouldn't make it as an actress, but she always wanted to live like an actress. She wanted to be rich, and she wanted to have lovely clothes and makeup and stuff. So she thought, well, if I can't be an actress, I'll be a playwright. And she started to write plays. The first play, which was put on Broadway, was a melodrama about her first marriage, her first disastrous marriage to Brokaw, called Abide With Me, and that was a flop. So when Harry Luce and his editors finally decided that they would not have her on their magazines, she had really rather wanted to be an editor at Life, I think. She said, well, then I'll go off and write a play. And she went down to the Greenbrier in West Virginia and in 3 days wrote The Women.
Wow.
And it was a huge success.
It still performed.
And became a movie, a very famous movie, directed by George Cukor with all the stars of the period. And so she went on from there and wrote a book about the search for Scarlett O'Hara, as a sort of parody of that, called Kiss the Boys Goodbye. And then the third play, which was a huge hit too, was called Margin for Error, which was about a Nazi consul in New York being guarded by Jewish policemen. It was a sort of comedy.
Interesting subject matter.
Interesting subject matter. And the most successful anti-Nazi play that ever was performed on Broadway, still to this day, I believe. And they were all made into successful movies. Otto Preminger directed Marge and Ferrer and starred in it, too.
Claire was a very political person, and yes. Many people remember her for her later politics, her anti-communism, her sort of hawkish views.
Yes. But
talk about her entry into politics and into the House and her politics at that time.
She got into politics really by chance because she was wanting to promote Wendell Willkie's campaign against FDR in the very fourth term. She ended up giving speeches for him, and she was a real rabble-rouser, as it turned out. She packed out Madison Square Garden and got standing ovations every time she spoke. So she realized that perhaps at heart she was a politician. And Henry was always encouraging of that because it was nice for him to have, if she could get elected to Congress, to have an ear, you see, as
yes.
to what was going on in Washington. And so she ran as representative from Fairfield County, Connecticut, and was elected. Actually, she ran twice.
And she was a liberal Republican during that period.
She was extremely liberal. She supported civil rights and female rights and profit sharing in factories and the GI Bill, minimum wages and all of that. Astonishing, considering she was elected as a Republican.
I mean, there's so many contradictions about her. One of the contradictions that's so interesting is that people either really loved her or they hated her, or they loved and hated her. You mentioned FDR earlier, and he called her a sharp-tongued glamour girl of 40. She also alienated Truman. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it was a matter of politics. I think she thought that FDR should have been a little bit more upfront with the American people about his intentions in World War II. But, of course, I think he didn't have any intentions of entering World War II until Pearl Harbor. He was happy to support the British, giving them old carriers and stuff and armaments. But he, I don't think, intended to enter the European War. But when Pearl Harbor happened, of course, at that point, too, Hitler declared war on America. So he had a war on two fronts, whether he wanted it or not. And she made the crack, which really haunted her to the grave, that FDR lied us into a war into which he should have led us.
Wow.
And they always dropped the second half of that quote, you see, and kept FDR lied us into war. And what she meant by that was he used to say, I am not going to send you mothers, I am not going to send your sons into any European wars, which I think he meant at the time. And in her old age, she admitted that she made a mistake about FDR and that she was too hard on him.
Now, she was incredibly sharp-tongued, obviously, and you knew her, as you said, well into her old age. Did she regret some other things that she had said? How did she sort of look back upon those years when she was such a well-known figure and controversial?
The only thing she voiced regret about, I think, she always thought that the Vanity Fair period of her life was the most interesting. She was meeting all the famous writers of the time and all the famous artists, and it was an exciting period to be in New York in the early 30s. But the only regret in later life that she expressed publicly was that she didn't continue with her playwriting career,
mm-hmm.
that she felt at heart that's what she really was. But the problem was that the kind of plays she wrote, which were acidic, funny, witty plays, after she'd been to the Eastern and the Western fronts, and after she'd been in the concentration camps, at the opening of those camps, she'd been to many of those, she didn't feel that she could write these funny lines anymore.
Right.
The life was too serious now. She also converted to Catholicism, and that made it even harder to write those plays where you were really rather nasty about particularly your own sex. The women was really not really vicious about the female sex of a certain kind.
Of course, we haven't mentioned her other lifetimes within her lifetime, her ambassadorship to Italy. But what for you as her biographer was the most interesting period of her life?
Well, the reason I ended up writing two volumes, which I never intended to do, was that I got really interested in her origins and how she got from where she started out to where she ended up. And how many fields she conquered and how many people she charmed and how clever and funny she was. Henry Luce always said she was the smartest person in any room, and he'd always thought he had been up to that point that he married her. So I got bogged down a little bit with volume one because I was so interested in the rise,
right.
how she achieved that. to make it to the Congress at the age of 39.
Her amazing. Mother had openly encouraged her to basically be a seductress.
Yes.
But, I mean, if you look at pictures of her, just in still shots, she wasn't really a great beauty,
no.
At least, you know, from that distance. But people who were in the same room with her had a very different reaction.
Yes, I think it was to do with the coloring and the translucent skin and the blue eyes and the combination, of course, of the charm. She could charm the leg off an iron pot, as my mother would say. And also the wit and the brilliance, because intellectually she really was. I've never been in a room, and I've been in a room with her, with a lot of famous minds. And she always stood out. She just was smarter than everybody.
What's your favorite Claire Booth loose witticism?
One of my favorites, because I relate to it so much, was that she said, the difference between an optimist and a pessimist is the pessimist is usually better informed.
That's great.
I like that one.
And we were laughing just before about what she said about widowhood.
She said that widowhood was one of the fringe benefits of marriage.
Right. And then of marriage, she said, in every marriage is really... Two marriages, right?
Two marriages. One rides the horse up front and the other is behind.
Right.
But of course, I don't think she believed that vis-a-vis her own marriage.
When I always find the subject of biographer and the biographer's subject to be very interesting, the relationship, and especially when you're dealing with a life that was so complicated and you've been working on it for so long. Did you feel in the end that you liked her, that you admired her, that you respected her? What were your feelings towards her?
In the end, I admired her tremendously. I know that she was a monster in many ways, and she was a monster of narcissism, because she really was a certifiable narcissist, I think, which is not her fault. It's because she started out with such bad parenting and ended up looking after her mother instead of her mother looking after her.
Right.
And that's, I think, skewed her in many ways. And as I think psychiatrists say, narcissism is incurable. But she did her best. She tried her hardest to be nice. But deep down, she had this darkness at the center, which is what somebody said of her once.
And now, having finished this project and having lived with it for so long, do you think you'll miss her?
I do miss her. I miss her very much. You miss the humor. You miss the life force. She was interested in everything. She always had the latest gadgets. Even at 80, she was talking, reading about science and chemistry and physics. She was just interested always in the world that was to come.
We haven't even talked about her foray into LSD, but I will leave that for readers to discover, because it is such a fascinating book, and she lived such an incredible life. Sylvia, thanks so much for talking to us about your new book.
Thank you for having me.
That was Sylvia Jukes Morris, and the book again is Price of Fame, The Honorable Claire Booth Luce. Carl Sagal and John Williams join me now to talk about what's going on in the literary world. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Pamela.
Hi, John.
Hey, Pamela.
There are a few stories percolating out there this week. The first, obviously, very sad one. Nadine Gordimer died this week at 90. Tell us a little bit about Nadine and her work.
Well, she was the Nobel Prize-winning author of, I think, more than two dozen works of fiction. And she's a South African writer. And beloved, but I think also very important in that for a lot of people, she gave a human face to apartheid, what was happening. And her books really sort of described every aspect of South African society. She really did try to put herself in the perspective of, you know, the Afrikaners, residents of these sort of black shanty towns. And
she didn't set out to be a political writer.
She didn't. She said in an interview once that she really, if she had been raised in a different place, she might not have written about politics at all. I think that she found that as she set out to write fiction and the issues she was investigating, she talked about how it was just sort of inevitable that she ran into these stories and that she couldn't ignore them. There was also in a Paris Review interview she did quite a while back now, I think it was 1983, you know, she talked very eloquently about how her political consciousness changed when she realized that it wasn't enough for her to just treat people in a certain way, that she had to sort of more aggressively confront these issues and talk about them publicly, and that it couldn't just be a private, I'm okay, so everything will hopefully work out. And she was very closely tied into these issues. I think that a lot of people believe that the Nobel Prize, which she won in 91, was the timing of it was tied very closely to also sort of honoring Nelson Mandela.
Right.
And
they were friends.
Acknowledging that issue. They were.
So she also faced some criticism later in life of a very different kind.
Well, I think that you saw this a little bit with Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who is another really obviously legendary author who died recently, that where their sort of liberal politics about certain causes were championed, other people, you know, on the other side of the political spectrum felt that, for instance, the way that she wrote later in life about Castro's Cuba, you know, that she maybe became too sympathetic to other causes that maybe weren't as righteous. But that's obviously just an open debate that that people that will probably rage forever.
What's the novel that she's most well known for?
It's a book called Berger's Daughter, and I think it was a third of her books to be banned. And it was a story of a child of a family of revolutionaries who sort of finds her way to her father and to the cause.
All right. Another total change in topic, but another story that began this week, started in an unusual way, although maybe a more increasingly usual way. What happened on Twitter this week?
Well, the novelist David Mitchell, who is very popular and has a very big new novel coming out in the fall, gave his fans a little bit of something to tide them over in the meantime. And he started a story on Twitter, which authors are increasingly doing. I think Teju Cole, who's very well known for his Twitter experiments, has done this a couple of times, sometimes with the help of sort of crowdsourcing. He has people, you know, write sentences and then he puts them together. But Mitchell has started this himself now.
Yeah, Mitchell is, and I think the author of
Cloud Atlas, most
Black Swan Green, and the new book is Bone Clocks. But I think Mitchell's is different because Teju's always playing online. And playing with people on like Twitter. But I think Mitchell's feels more like Jennifer Egan did something around the publication of The Goon Squad, sort of tied to the publication of actual books. Sometimes they'll even be tweeting lines of stories in a book. And this is part of like a Twitter fiction experiment that I think people have been trying to get going. I know Twitter's been invested in trying to see if Twitter can be a storytelling sort of vessel. Like they actually even got the novelist Elliot Holt a few years ago to write a story on Twitter. She created separate Twitter accounts and like I think like six or seven different people reporting
mystery.
On a murder that they saw at different places, and it was non-chronological. It was a lot of fun.
Right.
So I think it's still a place of experiment.
It kind of reminds me, there's of course the six-word memoir. And now I think The Guardian a couple of years ago asked authors to tell an entire story in 140 characters or less, which can be a little bit more than six words perhaps, but also less in more ways than one. I think romance novelist Jackie Collins wrote, "She smiled, he smiled back. It was lust at first sight, but then she discovered he was married. Too bad it couldn't go anywhere." I think other authors have taken a lot more space to say pretty much that same thing.
It's funny that David Mitchell, of all people, is doing this because, you know, when you do think about Cloud Atlas in particular and some of his other books, they're so sprawling and ambitious and uncontainable that for him to sort of go to the 140 characters is and constrain himself that way is pretty funny.
I suspect The Bone Clocks will be a very different book.
Yes, not tweetable.
Right.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
Thank
Pamela.
You, Pamela.
This is Greg Coles. I'm an editor at The Book Review. David Layman is the series editor of the Best American Poetry series. He is also the editor of the Oxford Book of American Poetry and a poet himself, whose books include most recently New and Selected Poems. He teaches in the graduate writing program at the New School and lives in New York City and in Ithaca, New York, where he joins me now on the phone. In both the shorter and the longer version of this essay, you revisit C.P. Snow's famous Two Cultures lecture from Cambridge in 1959, and you declare that in the intervening years, technology has routed the humanities. The C.P. Snow, he looked at the science of culture and the science of the humanities, and you say that there's just no contest anymore. Technology has become all-pervasive. It's infiltrated every aspect of our lives. And so that's in this shorter version as well as the longer version. I wonder, reading that argument, whether it's necessarily to the detriment of the humanities that technology has become so all-pervasive. Is it really a zero-sum game?
Well, I feel that we have to live with reality. And our reality has changed decisively, I think, because of advances in technology. Once we acknowledge that we who love the humanities, we who love poetry, art, music, and so on, have to figure out ways for our arts to endure and survive and attract new followers, whether in collaboration with what tools new technology provides or despite the obstacles posed by the new technology. I feel that it's unquestionable that Snow was right. It gives me no pleasure to say that. I wish we had done a better job back in the 60s when Leavis and others defended the humanities against Snow's, I think, somewhat smug assumption that science was the more important for the progress of mankind and was doing things that were invaluable for humanity, whereas the humanities were resistant to any change, including ameliorative change. And he went so far, Snow did, as to draw a line between some of the major authors of the early part of the 20th century and their, in some cases, odious political views.
We should note that Snow was himself a novelist as well as a scientist, but judging from the argument, maybe a happier scientist than he was a novelist.
He was a very, very successful novelist, a very popular novelist. Leavis heaped scorn.
This is F.R. Leavis, of course.
Yes, F.R. Leavis, the Cambridge don, who was a very feisty man and had
a very prominent literary critic in his day, and he responded 3 years after the C.P. Snow lecture.
That's right, a lecture it also delivered as Snow's was at Cambridge University, and Leavis felt that Snow's novels were inadequate by the standards of Conrad or Dickens, and perhaps that's so, but I think those novels, you know, are pretty good as far as they go. There's one called The Masters about a college at Cambridge and the political divisions inside as they have to seek a new president is something that, you know, people could read for knowledge of how power works. So Snow was not a complete washout as a novelist by any means. His heart was with the scientists, I think.
Your heart is with the poets. I wanted to return to this question of technology versus the humanities today. You say that artists have no choice but to work within the constraints of the world given them and to adapt to technology, either to work around it or to work with it. I wonder in what ways you think technology actually hinders the arts, and in what ways do you think it might help it, and specifically poetry?
Well, it hinders the arts in the sense that our time span has been under assault, and the entire culture seems to be suffering from a form of attention deficit disorder. So that if you're teaching a class, as I do every year at the New School in New York City on great books, I now have to ask myself, how many weeks will it take for the students to read Anna Karenina? In my college days, you would have 1 week to read this mammoth novel, and you couldn't do that anymore. You can't have that expectation any longer. You can also not have the expectation that people will have read some of the formidable texts of Western civilization. And there are multiple reasons for that, but technology is one of them. Now, at the same time, we have the fact of the technology and the fact of the Internet. Maybe there are ways we can exploit these new media to get our own message out, or to allow the new media to affect our style of exposition so that the poetry can be translated, so to speak, into a new kind of medium.
I wonder, the language is always changing, of course, our language. Do you think it's changing faster these days as a result of technology? And how is that affecting poetry?
It's always changing. It's affecting poetry directly. The words are entering the poems. Furthermore, the means of writing affects the outcome. So that, for example, if you are used to writing instant messages, you may use that as a model for what a poem might be like, for the length of a poem. Or you might incorporate the dialogue form that is in an instant message box. Or the way when you read a blog, there's a trail that follows it. There's a form concealed in this structure. You might find parodies of it, or you might find subtler ways of incorporating that into your writing.
I think of poets like certainly Patricia Lockwood, Melissa Broder, Saeed Jones, who are all very active on Twitter and have you know, an almost tweet-like voice in their poetry.
I think that's very true, and I think that is a reflection of the way the language works today. Billy Collins is a poet who's very, very popular. I mean, I think he's an excellent poet. He's also been a beneficiary of the radio, for example. His poems go over very well to a radio audience.
Also technology, of course.
Yes, and Garrison Keillor would read them. Terry Gross, maybe on Fresh Air. And that helped build an audience for Billy Collins.
So do you think Twitter could be the next generation's radio, that it, in fact, it just offers a new medium for artists to find a larger audience?
It could be. I have a poet friend, Denise Duhamel, and we collaborated on Best American Poetry 2013, and she's a very quick study. And so let's say I have an idea for a collaborative poem. I might write her in an email my line, and she will write back to me almost immediately, and we will be building a poem collaboratively as if we were in the same room. So this is an obvious way in which you're making use of a new technology. There are obvious benefits. I write books. I remember when I was a very young man, there were no computers, and so you had to cut and paste literally if you were going to move blocks of text around. So writing a book is so much easier now. And then getting it to your publisher, you can send it as an attachment. These are incredible advances. I'm not entirely opposed to the new technology. I think you have to accept actuality before you can alter it or modify it in some way. But your point about those poets you named is very true. And look at that rape joke poem and how it went viral and benefited from the internet. Got a huge audience.
Absolutely. In your role as series editor of the Best American Poetry books, you're sitting in the referee's chair, as it were. Have you seen big changes in poetry with the rise of a tech-savvy generation?
I've seen big changes in poetry since our first volume came out in 1988. Some of that is sort of the inevitability of change over a 30-year period. When we started out, the names on the scene included James Merrill and James Schuyler and Mae Swenson and Kenneth Koch and Anthony Hecht and John Hollander and Robert Creevy and Adrian Rich, and not one of them is with us now. And we have a new generation, and demographically it's far more diverse. There's been good news culturally in that we have a much higher percentage of poets with talent and skill and exposure to a public who are African American, who are Native American, who are Hispanic American, who are women. All of these groups were arguably underrepresented prior to a certain year in the 20th century, but that's no longer the case. You find terrific poetry, and it's not specific to the gender or race in its content. So you often get to read poems, and nothing in the poem itself tells you that this poem is written by an Asian American. There's some outstanding Asian American poets who are surfacing. I notice when these things happen.
How much of that do you think is due to political change, and how much do you think is due to technological change, and how much do you think is just due to the progress of time?
In my position, you said I'm kind of a referee. I think of it more like it gives me a lot of pleasure to encounter a new poem that's good, whether it's by somebody who's been slumping or it's by somebody I've never heard of. It's good for the art, and I think it's going to be good for me as an editor. So I feel that I'm an advocate in a way for my field, poetry. Many people have talked about how limited the audience is, that no one reads poetry or that no one buys the books. I'm of the faction that believes that we can do something about that and recruit new readers, because poetry is a passion, not only of mine, but of so many different people, and it's good to get them involved. It doesn't matter if what they write amounts, you know, to a hill of beans. It's good to get them involved, to get them reading poetry, and to be involved with poetry. It's good for the soul. It's good for our values.
It's terrific. You started your essay by talking about an episode when John Hamm was on the Craig Ferguson show. Craig Ferguson asked him, is he on Twitter? So I'll close our interview by asking you, are you on Twitter?
Well, I am sort of.
Under a sock puppet pseudonym?
I'm sort of on because we have a blog called for the Best American Poetry, and sometimes when we post something new, whether it's by me or someone else, we will put it on the Twitter feed. So I'm out there to that extent.
For our listeners, that is at Best Am Po. Am I right?
I think so.
I think I am too.
We have a Facebook page, but our blog has a managing editor who is more, you know, up to date with all the technological aspects. You know, one thing that your listeners might like to know about is we're doing a contest with the American Scholar magazine online under the heading Next Line Please, and we're building a sonnet, a crowdsourced sonnet.
A wiki sonnet.
Well, we're up to line 12, and we're looking for line 13 now. And if you go into any search engine and type in Next Line Please, you'll get there. And some of our lines are from, you know, noted poets like Frank Bidart, and some from the a senior class in high school in Maryland, whose teacher thought it would be a good exercise in class that day, and also some professors. And it's a weekly contest. It's a lot of fun. I see the relation between games, contests, and the writing of poems. What, after all, is a sonnet if not a kind of game that you're playing and trying to win?
David, thank you so much for spending the time with us.
It was a great pleasure for me, and it was a pleasure to work with you on the piece.
Very glad to have it.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
Most of the action this week is on the fiction side of things. The hardcover fiction list has six new titles. Starting down at the bottom at number 16, Terry Brooks, whose decades-long Shannara series continues with the start of a new trilogy, a new Shannara trilogy, Defenders of Shannara. The name of this book is The High Druid's Blade, and that is the first book in this trilogy. Then at number 13, another longtime regular on the list, Anne Rivers Siddons, a Southern novelist, has a novel called The Girls of August. At number 10, Rainbow Rowell, who's really best known, I think, as a young adult novelist, and her book, Eleanor and Park, her young adult novel, Eleanor and Park, remains on the young adult list after 32 weeks. It's number 7 this week. But she does have a novel for adults now. It's not her first novel for adults. It's called Landline, and that is new on the list at number 10. And then we have three new titles right at the top of the list. Starting at number 3, a debut novel from Eden Lepucky called California. This is the book, you may remember, Stephen Colbert has really given a big push to this. He's published by the Hachette Book Group, the French book group that owns Little Brown and Grand Central.
And it's in a little bit of a fight with a big...
Little bit of a fight with Amazon. And Lepucky is also a Little Brown author. So Colbert has told his audience of viewers to go out and buy this book and do what you can to get it onto the list. And here it is. Debut novel, making its debut on the list at number 3. So not too shabby, Stephen Colbert. At number 2, not a debut novel, Catherine Coulter, another longtime regular on the list, has a novel called Power Play. This is part of her ongoing series about the FBI agents Dylan Savage and Lacey Sherlock. And then at number 1, another series novel by another longtime regular on the list, Brad Thor's new novel, Act of War. It's a new Scott Harvath novel, and it debuts right at number 1.
And what about nonfiction?
Well, on the nonfiction side of things, there's just one new title this week. It is Dinesh D'Souza's book, America. He wrote it as an accompaniment to a documentary that he did, also called America. Both the documentary and the book have been out for almost a month now, but the book has just been bouncing around the extended list. And suddenly this week it surged all the way up to number 2. All I can figure is that people who watched the movie have finally gone out to buy the book. It is Dinesh D'Souza, of course, is a prominent conservative commentator, and this offers his familiar take on things.
Unless people were looking for July 4th gifts for that special someone.
Maybe that's why it's there. I should also note that Edward Klein's Blood Feud, about the purported clash between the Clinton and Obama families, is still ahead of Hillary Clinton's own book, Hard Choices, on the list. Edward Klein is at number 3, and Hillary Clinton's Hard Choices is at number 4.
And I think Amy Chozick and our new publishing reporter, Alexander Alter, had a story on that this week as well.
They did, yes. The anti-Clinton book is selling better than the bi-Clinton book.
All right. Well, we'll see who comes out on top next week. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.